Well, tonight on Coast to Coast with Paulino, we are going to be talking about the paranormal experience. Lots of things that have happened in history through the paranormal that has affected us. We'll also talk with him about his book called The Bell Witch Project. So Paul's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Paulino back with us. He has been called one of the most intelligent voices in the paranormal research. He began his career as an investigator back in 1970 at the age of 17. He has had some adventures with famous hauntings, of course. He's been on our program before. He and his son, Paul, of course, involved in all kinds of things, including Behind the Paranormal, which is his own radio version show. Welcome back, Paul. Always a pleasure. How are you?
Oh, pretty fair. How are you doing, George?
I'm good. And you know what? How old is Ben now? He's not a kid anymore, is he?
No, he was a babe in arms last time he was on with you. Now he has graduated from Emerson College with a degree in sound design and audio post-production, and he's getting married. So if there are any producers listening, he's looking for a job.
And where do you want to? Where do you want him to work? Any place?
Any place he can get a job. He'd like to stay on the East Coast, but he'd head out your way if required.
Okay, well, we might have some names for you, Paul, so let's,
okay.
Let's keep in touch on that. So what is new since we talked about 7 years ago?
Four, actually, George. Four, yeah. Time flies when you're having fun. A lot is going on. We have taken to investigating flap areas, and this is where we started to get into history. We've been over to Rendlesham Forest in England and have been tracing paranormal phenomena beyond what was reported. Now, in that case, for example, Rendlesham Forest, the 1980 UFO sightings by Air Force personnel, et cetera, were the center of the things, and that's all people concentrate on. But if you look at the area and its history, you have stuff going back to Saxon times, all happening in that one area. We've uncovered things still going on. When we spoke over there in 2012, people were coming forward with things that happened to them, almost like the things that happened to the people in the Air Force in 1980. So we've been doing a lot of work on that. One area we're working on is in central Connecticut, Litchfield County, where it started with ghosts in 05. And the woman read my book, Footsteps in the Attic, and said this approach that I take, which is quite different, as you know, from other investigators, was the only thing that explained all the bizarre and seemingly unrelated things that were going on in her property. Well, that morphed by 2009, because we looked beyond the property to other people and other things that were going on. It morphed into people seeing grays in their bedrooms and UFOs, people getting out of their cars, looking at UFOs at night, and military activity, which we traced down to a certain farm. That's going to have to be for another time, because I've just got some new information from someone involved with the intelligence community on that, and it's quite interesting. But, again, these things all can be traced back through history. And, you know, George, when things happen historically, it isn't necessarily that they happened as reported in the folklore or in the reports or the stories, but that people believe that they happened.
Yes.
And that can influence society and history and politics and you name it. So we've been busy.
And we've got lots to talk with you about tonight, Paul. You had written a book called The Bell Witch Project. Now, that was an episode from the early 1800s. Can you update?
If I may, George, actually, I'm not the author. I'm just a contributor. Sean Castile and the great Timothy Green Beckley are the actual authors, but I contributed to it, as did Sean Robbins. But
you get credit. Hey, take your bow, because it was an important work.
Well, thank you. I think it's a good book.
What's going on?
Anyway, yeah, it was the early 1800s, George. It started really in 1817 and went more or less until 1821. Now, again, one of the things here is that you really can't be sure, because there are very few sources and there are several different versions of this. But nevertheless, I tend to think that there was a lot of validity to it. In 05, they were making that film, The American Haunt, or An American Haunting, with Donald Sutherland and Sissy Spacek. And some of the producers were interested in doing a DVD to go with the film's DVD, like a featurette, and they were going to have me work with Andrew Warney on that. And it never came about because they cut the budget, but nevertheless, I found out some interesting things about this. It had to do with the Bell family of Tennessee, again, as I say, 1817, There was John and Lucy Bell, and they had four children, four sons and a daughter. Now, this all seemed to begin with a property dispute with a neighbor known as Kate Batts, okay? Nobody really liked her, and she was known as Old Kate, and hence, given what happened afterwards, she was considered the Bell Witch. That's where the name of the case came from. They had a property dispute. The local church said that they were Bell was in the wrong, but nevertheless, Kate wasn't satisfied either, so Kate more or less supposedly cursed John Bell and his daughter Betsy. Now, again, this is the best I can get out of the story.
I
believe that this is something like this more or less happened. So everything kind of went along very briefly until one summer day when John Bell was out in his cornfield and he all of a sudden saw a large black creature. And he described it like a dog, a huge dog with a rabbit's head. Now, if he has eyesight like I do, wasn't wearing his glasses, he might have just seen a donkey or something.
But and shot at it, yeah.
Yeah, he was a farmer. He did shoot at it, but there was no effect upon it, and it disappeared. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because it starts as a classic poltergeist case, such as I've experienced or have studied. There was pounding that started on the walls of the house at night, at first outside, then inside. And as always happens in these cases, it started lightly, and then it got louder as time went on. Not all poltergeist cases go this far, but it began, voices started to be heard. At first, they were whispers, and they said, well, it sounded like a woman singing. And then another person said it sounded like a woman singing a hymn, right? Now, Betsy Bell was the youngest child in the family. She was 11 when this began. All of a sudden, something started pulling her hair and hitting her. Welts would be seen on her face and her arms and back, and I've seen that too. Then something started pulling covers off people's beds, you know, other members of the family. The voices got stronger. They shouted at Betsy. They didn't like the fact, now again, she's 11, but you know, this went on over a few years, so she got a little bit older, and people
yeah.
didn't waste time in those days. So she became engaged to one Joshua Gardner. It would taunt them, this entity or entities, and finally to the point where Betsy broke off the engagement in 1821. Now, much as John Bell tried to prevent it, the story of this got out. People started coming to see and hear this thing. What the local minister tried to, you know, do an exorcism, and it didn't really work. And, of course, nobody grabbed poor Kate. I don't know if it was poor Kate or not, but nobody grabbed Kate Batts on this, because this is long after witch trials had gone out of style. So, you know, she was allowed to continue. There were voices, and I find this interesting, there were as many as four voices with this thing. It sang hymns, quoted scripture, told hilarious jokes, carried on conversations with people that were quite intelligent, and it even, at least once, and some sources say more than once, quoted word for word two sermons that were preached at the same time, on the same day, 13 miles apart, there in Robertson County, Tennessee. So, again, word spread about this. And the more attention it got, and I'll tell you later what I think this really was,
okay.
You can probably guess, the stronger it got. And hence, you know, that's why in these poltergeist cases, the more fear, the more annoyance, the more anger these things generate, you've got strength coming from this, that the things feed on it and get stronger, and hence a poltergeist can result. All right, a poltergeist is generally defined as people think it's sometimes generated by a so-called agent, the person it's picking on, or it might be some sort of demon, as Ed and Lorraine Warren thought we were running into in that Bridgeport case in 1974. But I think it goes beyond that. But in any case, objects are moved, people are sometimes hit. I myself have been injured by these things, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what a poltergeist is.
They don't. That doesn't sound friendly, does it? If people are getting
hurt. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I don't know. There are a lot of feelings you get when you're going through this, and they don't always match the theories. But anyway, word on the Bell case spread, and supposedly, and I don't know if I believe that this actually happened, but Andrew Jackson, then a general, was in Nashville. He heard about this, and he wanted to see it for himself, and because he became president years later in 1828 or 29. But he took a great interest in it. Supposedly, it helped him get out of a mud hole his wagon had been stuck in. I don't know if I really, there's really no evidence for that. But this Kate, again, continued to get stronger, if that's what it was. And it was very interesting here. And here's where the history comes in, I think, George. It got to the point where it was strong enough to wander around the county giving advice. It even supposedly saved the life of a little boy who was caught in a cave-in at one point. At other times, there seemed to be very positive acts, sometimes very negative acts. It would sometimes set people against one another. As I say, it would give agricultural advice, matchmake, things of this kind.
Are we sure, Paul, that we were dealing with just one entity? What if there were a couple of them?
I think there were four, actually. Okay.
Good ones and bad ones.
I'm sorry?
Good and bad.
No, I think that, let me jump ahead here and give you what I think was really going on. Historically, if you look back at some of the earliest experiences of the human race, I mean, you have the Sumerians who started out, and many religions all over the world started out, and people were surprised to hear this in the 30s when they started talking about this. They started out as monotheistic, worshiping
right.
one god, or at least a family, a father god, a mother god, and a child, which was usually us. And you can almost see this kind of Trinitarian thing getting started, which was no new idea. But then all of a sudden, about 5 to 8,000 years ago, the Sumerians, all of a sudden they're worshiping 5,000, that's no exaggeration, 5,000 gods, demigods, demons, things of this kind. You know, where did that come from? So I tend to think that entities like this thing or things that caused the Bell Witch case may very well have had their dirty little hands in our history, making people think they were gods. You know, I'm sure you've been to the British Museum, at least when the last time I was there in London, there were galleries on either side with gods from the old days. On one side are the kind of the nice ones like Isis and Osiris and those guys. And then on the other side are these nasty little kind of backyard deities that wanted blood sacrifice and all this stuff. Who would choose to adopt such loveless, nasty gods? Only people who think they had no choice, maybe. I don't know. I think things like came into Robertson County, Tennessee in the early 19th century, literally came into other communities and kind of took over. Had this not been a Protestant community with its feet on the ground, I think this thing might have taken over. And people would ask it questions, and it demonstrated a fascinating trait that I've noticed among other parasites. First, the only thing it would say was that it had been in the area for centuries and had Native American connections. Now, interestingly, there were the mound builder civilization around there at the time, all the way from what's now the Canadian border all the way down to the Gulf, pretty much in the center of the country, including that area of Tennessee. There was a rather mysterious Native American culture that built huge mounds in the shapes of animals, and I'm sure you've discussed that. But we don't know really much about them, except that we believe they engaged in human sacrifice. What better way to ring a dinner bell for parasites who feed on suffering, you know, and feed on negativity? And I think these things had been in the area for centuries, maybe as they said, but one of the most fascinating tendencies of these parasites is that the longer they spend attached to a human host or in our world, if you will, parallel world, the more they tend to forget their own origins. There are about 9 different species of these things, and I've seen them, the lower ones especially, attached. I'm thinking particularly of a very well-known artist in New York. I can't tell you the person's name, but this person came to us several years ago, had a terrible time with what appeared to be a parasitical entity of a low variety for 25 years or more. This would throw this person down the stairs and all this business. And the thing was afraid to detach because it was like a child. It didn't know, it couldn't remember where it came from or where it was supposed to go or where it was supposed to get food if it detached from this host. And so that seems to be the case in many times in these things, and I think the Bell Witch situation may have been one of those. And despite the baggage of the story may have picked up over the years, I recognize it as stuff I've seen before.
But where does the evil and the good come in? I mean, when you were talking about sometimes it did great things for people, other times it did not, why would it change?
Because it likes to push buttons. This is what these things do. To keep them guessing, You know, it's almost like the government when people talk about cover-ups. You know, keep them guessing, give good information from bad sources, bad information from good sources, and everybody loves a mystery. And this thing kept these people fascinated. And again, you know, had this not been a community and with another agenda, it might have taken over. So I think it was pushing buttons. And when people get again annoyed or angry or fearful, it fed upon it and got stronger and stronger. And that's the pattern in these cases.
As of today, is the Bell Witch still a big story in Tennessee, or has it faded?
Well, I think it's faded. It never was really that big of a story. There were two. Let me think now. There was the first published article was 1849 in the Saturday Evening Post, which is decades after this occurred. And there was a history of Tennessee written by a fellow named Goodspeed in 1888. And then there was a book that the movie was based on, Brent Monaghan's The Bell Witch and American Haunting. And that supposedly is a manuscript by Betsy Bell's husband, who was her teacher. Today he'd probably go to jail for this. But he was her teacher when she was a kid and ended up marrying her later
on.
Yeah,
he'd go to jail today.
Most of this stuff. So, in any case, there's very little information. But again, looking at our pattern of flaps in paranormal history, there are still things supposedly going on in this area today in Robertson County, Tennessee. And Ben and I haven't had a chance to check it out as we have Rendlesham or Litchfield County, Connecticut, but that's one of our things on our list of things to do.
Now, you have looked at how U.S. history has been affected by some of these paranormal experiences. Let's go through a list of them, and then we'll highlight each one of them after the break. And how did you get these cases?
Well, they're out there. When I was a reporter, and I'm still a working journalist, but when I was a reporter, wet behind the ears, I loved history, and I decided to look at some of the things that I could write about as when I wasn't writing news, I was writing feature stories.
Yeah.
And that's how I came up with a lot of this stuff. Other times people will tell you about it or it's in the literature. So you get around and you pick things up.
Some of the cases, of course, have had an incredible effect on us today. Let's go through some of the examples that you've illustrated. Let's talk about the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, that's convenient for us because we live less than 20 miles away from it.
And
this illustrates that Native Americans were probably the first ones, certainly around our area, certainly in North America, who were aware of bizarre things. And you look back at the cave art, especially in the Southwest today, and you see almost and many alien astronaut, kind of ancient astronaut believers will point to these. It's very difficult to dismiss them as anything other than at least supernatural beings.
Mm-hmm.
And had early people not experienced what they believed were supernatural beings or things of this kind, there would probably be no religion today and maybe no science, because the paranormal really is the mother of both science and religion, you know. And they really don't have they're really not at war as people think they are, at least they weren't until recently. So in any case, the human experience is full of that. But the Bridgewater Triangle is an area of over 220 square miles. People are surprised at that. It's practically within sight of Boston, and it's really the Hockomock Swamp Management Area. In there, at the area of Bridgewater and that central area between that part of Boston and the Cape Cod is essentially this triangle. And it does seem to be a triangle. The Hockomock Swamp, the name is a Native American name that means, it translates roughly place of spirits, and not necessarily good ones, all right? The Wampanoag tribe was involved there, that was part of their land, and they still have a meeting place there, but they'll only go there once a year, some have told me, because they're afraid of they don't like the Puckwudgies.
What are they?
Funny word, right? And they say it's not their word, but these are one of the many phenomena that have occurred there from the beginning of human memory until today. People still say they see them, and they're little people.
Huh. Right? Hold on, Paul. We'll come right back to this in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Paul Eno, our special guest, as we talk a little bit about the paranormal side. We'll be back, get into this situation of the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts, and a number of other cases in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Paul Eno with us. Paul, let's get back into this incredible story here in Massachusetts. And the depiction on the caves, clearly non-human. Were they the ones with the big heads and the big eyes?
Yeah, and sort of almost halos and rays and things around the top. It's pretty hard to argue that it's not something, as I say, at least supernatural,
yeah.
If not alien, whatever you may mean by alien. But the UFOs were seen in this area as well, in the Bridgewater Triangle. Bigfoot, which at one point in the 70s picked up a police cruiser by the back end with the poor police officer still in it.
Oh, boy.
And it's a wonder he didn't retire and become a shepherd or something. But, you know, and because it dropped the cruiser, and it was a terrible thing. Giant birds, there's even a hill named Bird Hill where this was seen. Giant snakes, which you don't need necessarily. Bigfoot and ghosts and poltergeists around the area. And the Pukwudgies are interesting because I actually talked to a man 2 years ago who swears that he was walking his dog. And it's a public land. There's all sorts of trails and all this sort
yeah.
of. He was walking his dog after dark, and he saw this little figure in the trail that was gesturing him to come forward. And it was kind of misty and something out of a movie, but he swears this is true. And something told him not to. I mean, duh. And they went the other way, and he never saw the thing again. So people still see this stuff today.
These little people that you were talking about before the break, how small?
Well, it's supposedly 2 to 3 feet high, from what I've heard.
Hmm.
So,
like leprechauns, that kind of look?
Oh, kind of, yeah. And matter of fact, here in Rhode Island, there are, because everything in Rhode Island is miniature, right? And it's so small.
Including the
but
state,
there,
yeah.
There are stone chambers in western Rhode Island that nobody knows what they were for, but they look like they could have been dwellings for something, and they're just miniature. And around Audubon Society land in Foster, Rhode Island, anybody can go and see them. So, I mean, who knows about this stuff? And, of course, the legends of little people are all over the world. And I ran into fairies, as it were, in Puerto Rico one time. So, yeah, these things are pretty universal. But, near here in the dear old Bridgewater Triangle, you seem to have all of it.
Now, before we get into some of these other cases, you and your son, Ben, are doing something to help some of the survivors of the horrible Nepal earthquake.
George. Yeah, anyone who buys any of my books from the website behindtheparanormal.com, between now and Saturday, we're going to donate $1 to Action Against Hunger, which is one of the best charities, in my opinion, and they're doing a lot for survivors of the earthquake in Nepal.
All of that all adds up, too. So that's
yes.
Very nice of you to do that. The margins of books these days isn't that great. So
No.
What's your next favorite episode out there in the United States that is there?
Well, one of them is a kind of a favorite to me because I was born about a mile from where it kind of began, and it was one of the central figures was one of my own ancestors, Nicholas Disborough, and this is at Hartford, Connecticut. And a lot of people don't realize, of course, everybody thinks about the Salem witch hysteria.
Yeah.
In Salem, Mass., which went on in 1692, but lasted really for less than a year. To the west, in the central Connecticut area, Hartford, and then down in the Fairfield area, there was a witch hysteria that lasted for 50 years. And it started in roughly about 1647 and lasted really until 1697. And one of the prompts for this were our dear old friends, these parasites or poltergeists, and children would wake up complaining of hands around their throats at night. And I've seen that kind of thing. Maybe they were just, some of them were sick or there was some imagination. But, you know, it makes you wonder when you hear so many reports from so many people in the same period. And my ancestor, Nicholas Disborough, who was also a famous furniture maker, one of the first in the American colonies, and if you have one of his pieces of furniture, you probably can retire on it. I don't have any, of course. He was involved in a poltergeist attack that occurred in 1683, which was way after this started, but it really got things heated up again. Now, he lived in Hartford, and what essentially happened was that it was in 1683, as I say, and his house was attacked by stones. Something was throwing pieces of earth at him. Indian corn, the with the cob, you know, corn on the cob,
Yeah, tossed
not
at
cooked,
them.
of course.
Huh.
Yeah, and quite a few other things. And this is reported by the dear old Cotton Mather. Okay, Cotton Mather was a well-known Puritan minister at the time, chronicler of really New England history, and he really was the first paranormal author in America.
He was a bigwig then, wasn't he?
I'm sorry?
He was a bigwig then.
He was a big shot, that's right. And he often gets maligned. I think the Puritans often get a bum rap, but there were no prizes, but they had some good things about them. So anyway, my poor great, nine times great-grandfather here is getting pelted with all this junk. Sometimes it would come through the window, through the door, through down the chimney and hit him in the head. Sometimes from the floor of the room would just appear and come up. And in his shop, in his yard, it seemed to be picking on him. There didn't seem to be any violence or deliberate violence. And Mather, and he reports this, refers to a, quote, invisible hand, which is an assumption that I'm not sure about. You know, there's the question of whether poltergeists actually deliberately throw these things. I mean, I stood there in Bridgeport in 1974 with cops and firefighters, and we all watched the refrigerator float up in the air. I mean, what was a poltergeist actually doing that, or was it the conditions created by the multiversal intersects that allowed the poltergeist to manifest? Maybe that's for another day. But in any case, they believed it was a demon doing this, of course. They had limited information, as do most people today, and thought it was that. So Disborow and other people and another person was having a dispute about a chest full of clothes that this neighbor thought Disborow had taken from him. And again, it shades of the Bell Witch thing. Kate Batts and John Bell arguing about property. And you wonder, you know, is this negativity maybe prompting some of this stuff if all the other ducks are kind of lined up? So anyway, Disborow was not charged. They thought of charging him with witchcraft, as I say, but he was not, and other people were. And there were altogether about, I believe there were 35 deaths from this, or 35 people on trial. There were 11 people executed in Connecticut for this sort of stuff. And maybe it's, I don't know, it was my family or what, but somehow I seem to have an awful lot of cousins among those who were charged. Even in Salem, I'm related to two of the judges and the Putnam family, who were some of the accusers, and little Ann Putnam being one of the little girls as a first cousin, a bunch of times removed, of course. I'm not that old, you know, who was involved in this. So anyway, that's that was the Connecticut case. And Connecticut does seem to be a hotbed of these things. As I mentioned, the Litchfield, Connecticut case with ghosts, UFOs, you name it, going on, and it seems to be growing as we watch it. So Connecticut, of course, being a center there for that, more so than Salem.
Why would that be? What do you think's happening?
Well, I don't know. I think that there are certain places where, and to get back into this multiple worlds intersect kind of thing that I think is behind the paranormal, as opposed to dead people and spirits, which is probably the best way most people can understand it. But if you look at quantum physics, you've got apparently a parallel worlds. And Fred Allen Wolf was on our show and said he agreed with us. And all possibilities exist in these worlds. And, you know, you see your Aunt Jane skipping down the hallway 2 weeks after her funeral. You say, aha, it's the remnant of Aunt Jane. It's the spirit of Aunt Jane. But then again, why is Aunt Jane wearing clothes? Why does she still look like she has a body? Because she does, I think. This is a parallel world where she never died. And carrying on her life normal. I think a lot of paranormal events, particularly ghosts, are explainable in that way. Not all. But I think that there are certain places where these intersects occur more easily. And we used to take on investigations, before he passed away himself, a soil engineer and hydrologist who pointed out that when you have high water tables in areas of sandy or clay soil, as we do here on the East Coast in a lot of areas, especially near the ocean and some of the rivers, you're going to have a lot of activity conducting electromagnetic energy, which, of course, seems to be the boundary and the glue that holds this multiverse together and divides these different parallel worlds from each other. And again, that's a long story, but that there seems to be we seem to have a lot of that in the East Coast. And people say, why is New England more haunted? Well, maybe it's not. It's just there are more people to notice it. People have been around longer to notice it. And we have a lot of these soil and geotechnic factors that might contribute to this. So I think that, and that's why maybe the military and the government is interested, because they have to go where the intersects are in order to study them. And wouldn't we just love to weaponize the paranormal? So that's another story. But I think geotechnic factors have a lot to do with it.
Paul, one of the fascinating aspects of the past, George Washington and this angelic intervention that he apparently had.
Yeah, that's a strange one. Now, again, I don't know if I believe this, because it appeared in, I believe it was 1882 or 3 in a publication for Civil War veterans. I wasn't aware of any source of this story before that, okay? And supposedly Washington in 1777 was engaged, you know, was in the middle of this terrible winter at Valley Forge, certainly a low point in the Revolution, and he was thinking of surrendering. And a lot of his officers were urging him to do so, and this sort of thing. Supposedly one day he had been working in his office, had asked not to be disturbed, and all of a sudden what he described as a very beautiful female vision occurred to him. And he was at first kind of very nervous about this and couldn't really see. But she began to tell him not to surrender and that everything was going to be fine, and addressed him as son of the Republic. Now, immediately the red flags go up, George, obviously, when, you know, one of the most dangerous tendencies in history is for a nation to think that God is on their side.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people don't realize that during World War II, German soldiers who were, you know, pillaging Europe, had on their belt buckles, Gott ist mit uns, which is God is with us. I mean, good heavens. So, yeah, there's a very dangerous tendency. So one wonders. But as I say, people believed this story in the late 19th century, and you wonder how much, a lot of people believed it, and that's when America went out and started empire building. You know, the Spanish-American War, which my own grandfather fought in, and all this business. That's when we got Puerto Rico and grabbed the Philippines and all this stuff, and believed that we had a divine right to kind of expand to the point.
And we haven't stopped since.
Well, no, that's it. And Washington supposedly, this story got around. So Washington, what's interesting about this story is that this angel or whatever it was supposedly said to Washington, son of the Republic, look and learn, on several occasions, and supposedly showed him the future. And supposedly Washington wrote that he saw laid before him one vast plain, all the countries of the world, Asia, Africa, Europe, etc., and a very, very dark sea floating between America and Europe, and a hand rose. A great darkness fell on America, and you can see the Civil War. Now, obviously, if this person just came up with this story, writing it after the Civil War, you'd see the Civil War. But there are some things that he says about what goes after this in the 20th century that kind of make you wonder. He refers to a great war in America, great invasions, which, of course, have not occurred, but there are indications of two global wars, and of course there were two global wars in the 20th century, and a light as of the sun, a light as of a thousand suns is the actual quote, enveloping part of the world in America, and you know, that's kind of how they describe nuclear explosions. You know, now again, you don't want to go nuts with this, but you know, if this guy wasn't just spitballing about the future. Yeah, and again, who knows what the turbulent century we're in now holds. But anyway, here's this angel with the national flag and all this business. And the point being that whether this occurred or not, people believed it. And it did a lot, I think, toward encouraging American nationalism in the late 19th century, therefore influencing our history to a great degree.
Well, you know, if it happened, Paul, it was pretty darn prophetic. And it's
it certainly, you know, seems to be, again, depending on how you look at it. Now, with Nostradamus, it has to happen before you recognize that he supposedly said it.
But exactly.
This is pretty clear, some of this stuff, you know?
Did you jump in aside for a... Did you ever look at the European from, I think he was in the 1800s, Sternberger and his predictions? Uncanny.
I'm familiar with the name. I have not...
Uncanny. Not really. He predicted the train before the train occurred. He's predicted wars, but he's predicted a major third war, and because the other ones have all happened.
I can predict that.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, but how do we know that his manuscript or whatever his letters or whatever he used to do the predictions is legitimate. That's a question I always ask as one who studies history.
These people who, like Washington, you know, was it an angel or was it an ET or was it a ghostly apparition that came to
That's
him?
That's it. I often wonder about the labels we put on these things, George. You know, if you see a wispy thing, you know, zipping through your living room, aha, it's a ghost. But if you're out in a field and you see the same thing with maybe a ball of light over it, aha, it's an ET. You know?
That's right.
And I often wonder if the context of these things determines the labels we put on them. And, you know, we keep running into this in various cases, such as the flaps we've been investigating. People will see, aha, it's a ghost, and then all of a sudden the nature will change and it starts to act like an ET or gray or something like this. And you wonder, and especially these parasites. You know, when I was in that house in Bridgeport in 74, those things were alien. And I don't necessarily mean from other planets or whatever, they just were not human, they were alien. There was a feeling of sterility, almost a total lack of humanity. It was really bizarre. It was a terrible experience. And those are the same things I've felt in case after case in dealing with what I believe are these parasites. So how many of these things are pushing buttons to make people think they're aliens? I've had them make people think they were lovers from former lives. As soon as you tell them they don't believe that, the whole thing changes. So, I mean, it's the first day of school here with this stuff.
And why do you call them parasites?
Because that seems to be what they are. I don't think they're spirits. As again, I think they're about 9 different species. I don't believe they're servants of Satan. That's our folklore to explain them to ourselves, right? I think that they are life forms, multiversal. I've seen them operating in 2 or 3 worlds, parallel worlds at the same time, almost like an octopus kind of thing, just to feed. That's how they live. And again, they're living. I've had physical encounters with them in that Bridgeport house. I was trying to protect a little girl. This is all in Bill Hall's new book, The Haunted House Diaries. And I instinctively pushed against it. It pushed back, and I felt skeletal structure. I'm not being an anatomist. I can't tell exactly what kind of skeletal structure, but this knocked me for a loop. I never told the Warrens that occurred because they weren't in the house when that happened. It took me years before I would write about it because I didn't know how to deal with it. It was probably the most terrifying thing because it blew out of the water my preconceptions about what these things were, which at the time was that they were demons, spirits, you know.
Amazing work. Now, you're still working with Ben, or has he just given up on the paranormal end?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I'm still working with Ben. He's peacefully sleeping away right now where it's almost 4 in the morning where we are. But, he's doing fine. He's working on some sets. And, we're still in there. They've asked us to speak at a lot of UFO conferences lately because word has gotten out about this idea that these things are connected.
Yes.
You know, people seem really fascinated with it.
We're
busy out there.
There are a lot of religious types out there, too, though, that really believe that these are demonic forces. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, because when I started paranormal work, I was in the seminary studying for the
priesthood.
Yes,
you were. That's right. I remember.
And it got me thrown out a year or two before ordination, right? And I think the church and I both had a lucky escape, maybe. But nevertheless, I think that I can see why our folklore, our religion, our myth, you know, these are the vessels of the memory of the human race. We've experienced these parasites, I think, from the very beginning, you know, hence my contention that they've influenced our history, our culture, to a profound degree.
Hold on, Paul. Let's pick it up when we come right back. I can't believe how fast this night is going to. We'll be back.